matches A to B.
KABU is proud to present An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. All proceeds will benefit KABU Community Radio. One of America's most tireless and wide-ranging investigative journalists, David Barsamian is the host of Alternative Radio. Again, that's An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I am Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. A couple of topics I have today. This is one of those days where I come in and I think, where do I start? Sometimes I just don't know where to start. But I'm going to start with our special little secret police state and how it's working out in terms of local facilities. And then I'll turn to a minor problem that we have with nuclear war that seems to be persistent. First, you may have heard on Democracy Now! About the Chicago police and their special little more or less secret location. Where they more or less take people and more or less abuse them. And there's an article from The Guardian on it. It's titled "The Disappeared: Chicago Police Detain Americans at Abuse-Laden Black Site." It starts with, it's not really a secret location, but it's kind of a cloistered location. That's a quote of Richard Bertichek, a former Chicago police superintendent. Police on site, The Guardian writes, at the intersection of West Fillmore and South Homan refused The Guardian access to Homan Square on a frigid recent morning. Lawyers who seek access to Homan Square are typically turned away, but interviews with ex-cops, the few attorneys granted a measure of access, and one person who was detained inside for nearly an entire day, describe an unusual, secretive police compound complete with armored vehicles, pardon me just a moment there, surveillance gear, and places to hold people for interrogation. Brian Jacob Church was taken to Homan Square after police picked him up in 2012 on terrorism charges that he beat at trial. And speaking for myself, he beat the terrorism charges because they were pretty ridiculous. But that's another story. Returning to the text here, it's, he said, police first photographed him for a biometrics database, took him down a long cinder block hallway on a second floor, and handcuffed him to a bench bolted to the floor. He spent the next 17 hours there, approximately as it was a windowless room, and the lights were kept on overhead while police attempted an interrogation he described as a fishing expedition. Homan Square struck Church as the police equivalent of a CIA black site. Inside, he says he saw big, big vehicles that looked to him like the mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicles used by U.S. soldiers and Marines in Iraq and Afghanistan. When his lawyers were finally permitted access Church spoke with them through a 12 by 12 foot metal cage. And Church isn't the only person who's seen cages at Homan Square. Bursacek, Chicago's top cop from 80 to 83, said they're chain link metal cages stretching from floor to ceiling. And quoting him, much like going into, say, a factory where there are certain areas that are secure. And there's more at theguardian.com. So as I was saying, you may have heard that yesterday on Democracy Now. However, we here in Portland have our own version of a creepy totalitarian police facility. Go to the intersection of Bancroft and McAdam, that is 4310 Southwest McAdam, and you will find a large new building surrounded by high barbed wire fencing and at least 8 security cameras visible from the street. This is the ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement Building. There is no signage apart from the address number. Armed guards stand watch from enclosed kiosks. Wait. And you will see a large bus pull up marked Geo Transport, where one might find windows in an ordinary bus. There are instead plates of metal. Once again, this is right here in Portland at Bancroft and McAdam, 4310 Southwest McAdam. And this isn't new news, but I want to bring it up because we need to talk about totalitarianism. We need to talk about our little totalitarianism problem. There's so many things to talk about, as I was saying. Our little totalitarianism problem, our Jim Crow drug war problem, our Jim Crow incarceration problem, global climate change, so much. But, you know, today, totalitarianism begins at home. And, well, this article from Oregon Live, immigration offices, including holding cells, could move into South Waterfront District in Portland. It's by Ryan Frank, and it's actually from 4 years ago. And there isn't a lot on that facility. But this article starts, South Waterfront's glossy condo towers could have a new neighbor, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The federal government's landlord has signed a lease to consolidate two Portland immigration offices into a renovated building at the southern tip of South Waterfront. Skipping ahead, the new office would include temporary holding cells for people who violate criminal and administrative immigration laws. A feature that riled a neighborhood leader, quote, "This is not a welcome addition to one of Portland's premier neighborhoods," said Jim Davis, land use chairman for the South Portland Neighborhood Association. "It doesn't fit the zoning," he said. "That's just outrageous. If I lived in the Pearl, I wouldn't expect a jail to be open next to me," end quote. Poor Babu. I really don't care about his squeamishness about the jail, but I do kind of care about the fact that it's, well, closed in, creepy, and served by Geo Transport. Now I want to talk about Geo. Geo is Wackin' Hut. You've heard of Wackin' Hut. Pinkerton, Wackin' Hut. Privatized law enforcement. Privatized prisons. Quoting the Daily Kos, this is from 2013, the Pacific Northwest Geo Corp runs a prison, ostensibly a detention center for the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency in the Industrial District in Tacoma, Washington. There are over 1,000 persons incarcerated in this facility. Technically, they are held on civil proceedings. Specifically, they are charged with immigration violations rather than criminal offenses. But the facility has a full panoply of prison features. Immigration detainees from the state of Oregon were once held in local jails and transported to the immigration court, usually in Portland, Oregon, for their hearings. Once GeoCorp built its Tacoma prison in about 2003, all ICE prisoners from the state of Oregon were transported to that facility. Originally, transport was affected by federal employees. Now Geo Transport has taken over that task. The typical route from Oregon is simply north from Portland up to Tacoma on I-5. And of course, I can update this article by saying now they're going to this creepy facility with all the security cameras over on Bancroft and McAdam. Daily Kos writes, on March 20th, 2013, I was traveling to a conference with another immigration lawyer, and we happened to pass the Geo private transport bus. Most people who saw the bus would not realize it was a privately run prison transport. He said he snapped photos. I did not, he writes, however, attempt to photograph the front of the bus. I honestly felt it could result in problems with Homeland Security if I were seen to pull in front of the bus and start snapping photographs. Now, that's where I want to depart from the text and say, that's not the world I used to live in, but it is now, all these years into the Patriot Act. He writes, "Geocorp needs prisons, and it needs prisoners to survive." Here's a relevant quote. Omitting the blather from one of its Securities and Exchange Commission disclosure statements, quote, "Most of our revenues," this is Geocorp, Wackenhut, "are generated under facility management contracts which provide for per diem payments based on daily occupancy. Many of our contracts have no minimum revenue guarantees and simply provide for a fixed per diem payment for each inmate, detainee, patient actually housed. We are highly dependent on the governmental agencies to provide inmates, detainees, and patients. A decrease in our occupancy rates could cause a decrease in revenues and profitability." Recently, in California and Michigan, for example, Wackenhut Geo writes, "there have been recommendations for early release of inmates to relieve overcrowding conditions. A material decrease in occupancy levels at one or more of our facilities could have a material adverse effect on our revenues and profitability, and consequently on our financial condition and the results of operations," end quote. Geo, as I was saying, is the name of the corporation formerly known as Wackenhut, running prison facilities for our profit across the U.S. Here's some information from Wikipedia about Geo. And once again, I'm talking about the creepy damn facility, the closed up box with guards and cameras and barbed wire that is on McAdam and Bancroft, 4310 McAdam. In 2001, an inmate was murdered at Geo's Rio Grande Detention Center in Texas by two other inmates. In 2006, Geo was sued by the man's family and found liable for $47.5 million. It was upheld on appeal. On April 24, 2007, inmates rioted for 2 hours at Geo Group's New Castle Correctional Facility in Indiana, resulting in fires and minor injuries to staff and inmates. The Indiana Department of Correction concluded that its recent transfer of 600 inmates over 6 weeks from Arizona to a new section of Newcastle contributed to a lack of experience among prison staff, but held the inmates themselves responsible for the riot. The riot prompted Indiana to suspend further transfers of Arizona inmates, pending measures to help out-of-state inmates adjust to Indiana prison policies and to ensure inmates are transferred more gradually. Between 2005 and 2009, at least 8 people had died at the Geo Group-operated George W. Hill Correctional Facility in Delaware. In 2007, the Texas Youth Commission fired 7 employees after discovering inmates at the Geo-run Coke County Juvenile Justice Center living in deplorable conditions. In November 2010, plaintiffs filed a federal lawsuit against the agencies that operate and own the Walnut Grove Youth Correctional Facility. That would be Geo, would be Wackenhut, that would be people who run that creepy facility here in Portland, saying that the prison authorities allowed abuses and negligence to occur at the facility. The lawsuit states that prison guards engaged in sexual intercourse with the prisoners and smuggled illegal drugs into the facilities, and that prison authorities denied education and medical care. Former Walnut Grove warden and 8-term mayor William Grady Sims resigned and pleaded guilty to removing a female inmate to a motel for sex and pressuring her to lie about it. In 2012, 2 illegal immigrants in Florida turned themselves into police knowing that they would be transported to and housed in Geo's Broward Transitional Center, a 720-bed facility in Pompano Beach, Florida. It is the only privately owned immigration detention center in Florida. Their intention was to report on conditions inside the facility firsthand. These anecdotal reports included substandard or callous medical care, including a woman taken for ovarian surgery and returned the same day still bleeding to her cell, and a man who urinated blood for days but wasn't taken to see a doctor. In response to these and other serious allegations, Congressman Ted Deutsch of Pompano Beach wrote a letter in September 2012. 25 other congressional representatives signed on to the inquiry, wrote to ICE. And according to this, they still haven't received a response. That's congressman. So I'm a little concerned about this little totalitarianism problem that we have. Now, having said that, it's 13 minutes after 9 o'clock. You're listening to Press Watch. This is KBOO Portland. I have a little bit more information about that, but I'll leave it to you to look at it right now, because there is another problem kind of popping up. And as I was saying, it has to do with nuclear war. And I've been bringing this up. Sometimes when I bring up a topic on this program, I get some feedback. And sometimes I bring up a topic and it's just crickets. And, you know, that's the way it goes. That's good feedback. That tells me stuffing things about what people are thinking or not thinking, but this is something that I want to push back on. I'm getting crickets on nuclear war, and I'm not sure exactly why. So I asked myself, is it because the threat of nuclear war is not currently real? No, not at all. Is it perhaps that people know that the threat of nuclear war is real, but consider it distant? I think that might be close. Do people not realize, and this is, I think, gets a little closer, you know, people who care might listen to something like NPR and get the impression that there's no pending nuclear war. Definitely get that impression from National Pentagon Radio. But as I said, sorry, but this is real. I have to repeat this information. NATO member Estonia, this is from Russia Today. Oh, Russia Today, the enemy, who cares? They've got nuclear weapons. I'm going to keep saying that part. Who cares? They've got nuclear weapons. This is relevant. NATO member Estonia has held a military parade in the border town of Narva, just 300 meters, that's 1,000 feet from the Russian border. Tallinn. I guess the mayor is a longtime critic of Moscow, which it accuses of having... Oh, not the mayor, excuse me. Oh, how ignorant. Well, anyway, leader of Estonia, longtime critic of Moscow, which it accuses of having an aggressive policy towards the Baltic nation. Tuesday's military parade was dedicated to Estonia's Independence Day. Skipping ahead, over 140 pieces of NATO military hardware took part in the parade. And once again, remember, this is 1,000 feet from the Russian border, where the Russians are having counter demonstrations with tanks and guns and troops. Returning to the text, including four U.S. armored personnel carriers, M1126 Stryker, flying stars and stripes. Another foreign nation, the Netherlands, provided four Swedish-made Stridsfordon on 90 tracked combat vehicles. Stridsfordon on 90 is the name of the tracked combat vehicles. If I remember correctly, those are those little flat ones. Estonia also showed off its own howitzers, anti-tank, and anti-aircraft weapons, armored vehicles, and other hardware. 1,400 troops marched in the streets of Narva, 1,000 feet from the Russian border. This is what you call a provocation. There isn't any other reason to do it. Anyone with a damn bit of sense who did not want to provoke a nuclear nation to raising its hackles would not march 1,400 troops, howitzers, military equipment, tanks and guns and stuff 1,000 feet from the border of Russia. So, I want to raise a stink about this. The White House comment line is 202-456-1111. I tried it this morning. They said due to weather, it was down. Goodbye. The email for the White House for President Obama is president@whitehouse.gov. president@whitehouse.gov. William R. Polk was a member of the Policy Planning Council of the State Department during the Kennedy administration and is a historian. And he specializes in the Middle East. And he wrote an article on Counterpunch called The Cold War and Ukraine. And it was about this little problem of nuclear war. And he compares it with the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he has some authority in comparing it with the Cuban Missile Crisis because he was there. He was right there. And he knows how close the world got to a nuclear exchange. So, in the rest of the program, I want to talk about how close we are to nuclear war. And before I get into William Polk's summary, I want to say that there might be another reason that people are not worked up about nuclear war. The idea that it's inevitable and there's nothing we can do about it, and that it'll be quick and painless. For some people, certainly it will be quick and painless. I'll have some details on that in just a minute. For a great number of people, it's going to be a really horrible way to die. And part of the horror of dying in this way will be knowing that there is a really good chance that the human species, especially, and at least in the Northern Hemisphere, is going to be extinct. That's not an exaggeration. That's something that's been worked out very carefully and scientifically for a long time. But let me go to William Polk's summary. To summarize, he writes, it is almost certain that neither the American nor the Russian government could accept even a limited nuclear attack without responding. Second, there is no reason to believe that a Russian government faced with defeat in conventional weapons would be able to avoid using nuclear response, nuclear weapons. And speaking for myself, that's something that I've mentioned several times. There's no traction. What's happening? Is this buzz to you? I really have to wonder. Third, whatever attempts are made to limit escalation are likely to fail, and in failing, lead to all-out nuclear war. And fourth, the predictable consequences of a nuclear war are indeed an unimaginable catastrophe. He writes, these dangers, even if today seem remote, clearly demand that we do everything we possibly can to avoid the fate of the boiled frog. We can see that the water is beginning to heat up. We should not sit and wait for it to boil. We did not do so in the Cuban Missile Crisis. We and the Russians worked out a solution. So what should we do now? Once again, speaking for myself, this comes after he points out that there was a great deal more negotiation than the public was led to believe. The U.S. removed its Jupiter missiles from Turkey, which were threatening Russia, which is the whole reason for the Cuban Missile Crisis. Did you know that? Some people do. Returning to Polk's text, once again, this is from someone who actually experienced the Cuban Missile Crisis in the Kennedy administration. He says, consider these key elements. First, despite the implosion of the Soviet Union and the attempts to cut back on nuclear weapons, Russia and the United States remain parallel nuclear powers, with each having the capacity to destroy the other and probably the whole world. Hundreds, if not thousands, of our weapons apparently remain on hair trigger alert. I assume that theirs are similarly poised. Second, both Russia and the United States are governed by men who are unlikely to be able to accept humiliation and almost certain murder by super patriots in their own entourages, and would be forced to act even at the cost of massive destruction to their country. So pressing the leadership of the opponent in this direction is literally playing with fire, as President Kennedy and the rest of us understood in the 1962 crisis. Even if leaders want to avoid conflict at a certain point in their mutual threats, events replace policy, and leaders become bystanders. Third, both the Russians and the American people have demonstrated their resilience and determination. Neither is apt to be open to intimidation. Fourth, both the Russians and the Americans are guided in their foreign policy by what they believe to be core concerns. For the Americans, as the Cuban Missile Crisis and many previous events illustrate, this comes down to the assertion of a zone of exclusion of outsiders. America showed in the Cuban Missile Crisis that we would not tolerate, even at almost unimaginable danger, intrusion into our zone. And speaking for myself, that included Cuba at the time. Among the Russians, as their history illustrates, this is Polk's text again, a similar code of action prevails, having suffered, as fortunately we have not, horrifying costs of invasion throughout history, but particularly in the 20th century, Russians can be expected to block by any means and up to any cost intrusions into their zone. Fifth, we said that we understood this fundamental policy objective of the Russians, and officially on behalf of our government, Secretary of State James Baker Jr. agreed not to push our military activities into their sphere. We have, however, violated this agreement and have added country by constituent country of the former Soviet Union and its satellites to our military alliance, NATO. Sixth, we are now at the final stage, just short of Russia itself and the Ukraine, and the Russians know some influential Americans have suggested that we should push forward to the gates of Moscow. Those who advocate what the British once called a forward policy now see the necessary first steps to the arming of Ukraine, and finally, there is no way in which we or the European Union could arm the Ukraine to the level that it could balance Russia. Thus, they are likely both to give the Ukrainians unrealistic notions of what they can do vis-a-vis Russia, and to be seen by the Russians as offensive moves to which they might feel compelled to respond. Consequently, they could lead us into a war we do not want. So what to do? In a word, stop. Now, speaking for myself and paraphrasing Jim Hightower, if you realize what you're doing is digging a hole, you got to stop digging. Returning to the text, what we are now doing and what we contemplate doing is not in our interest or in the interests of the Ukrainians, and is perceived as a threat by the Russians. We cannot deliver on the policy we would encourage the Ukrainians to adopt by arming them without a war. Economic sanctions are a form of that war, but they are unlikely to accomplish what we have been proclaiming. So the logic of events could force the Russians and us to the next step, and that step to the next, and so on. Our moves in this direction could cause massive death and destruction. We should stop doing what does not work and not in our interests, nor in the interests of either Ukrainians or the Russians. But stopping on what terms? Again, this is William Polk, Kennedy administration official, experiencer of the Cuban Missile Crisis rating. He writes, having myself helped to negotiate two complex but successful ceasefires, I've learned two things. First, a ceasefire cannot be obtained unless both parties see it as less bad than the alternative. And second, a ceasefire is merely a necessary precondition to a settlement. So what might a settlement involve? The elements of a general settlement, I believe, are these. First, Russia will not tolerate the Ukraine becoming a hostile member of a rival military pact. We should understand this. Think how we would have reacted had Mexico tried to join the Warsaw Pact. Far-fetched? Consider that even before the issue of nuclear weapons arose, we tried to overthrow the pro-Russian Cuban government in the Bay of Pigs invasion and tried on several occasions to murder Cuban head of state Fidel Castro. We failed, so for two generations we have sought to isolate, impoverish, and weaken that regime. We would be foolish to expect that the Russians will not react similarly when challenged by an anti-Russian Ukrainian government. Thus, to press for inclusion of the Ukraine into NATO is not only self-defeating, it risks overturning a generation of cautious moves to improve our security and increase our well-being, and is pointing us towards at least a cold, if not a hot, war. We need to adopt a different course. Second, we must recognize the Ukraine is not part of our sphere of influence or dominance. It is neither in the Western Hemisphere nor in the North Atlantic. On the Black Sea, the concept of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is an oxymoron. The Black Sea area is part of what the Russians call the Near Abroad. I want to depart from this for a moment and say this is all in the framework of someone who's been in a U.S. presidency, which is not a framework that I personally share. He says that Ukraine is not part of our sphere of influence or dominance, and I really don't think that the sphere of dominance or influence from the Pentagon should extend anywhere. We should stop being Pentagon people. We should just stop, because that is war. How much proof do you need? Needs to be shut down. No more Pentagon. But returning to this text, because this is someone who's experienced in this nuclear brinksmanship, if you can call it that. Pure jackassery, absolute death play. He writes, the shared objective is that the Ukraine become a secure, prosperous, and constructive member of the world community. Becoming such a member can be accomplished only by the Ukrainians themselves, but as all qualified observers have seen, excuse me, Ukrainian society and political organization have far to go to reach our joint objective. Speaking for myself, yeah, they're full of Nazis. Returning to the text, this is true regardless of the Russian-American dispute. It's government is corrupt, tyrannical, and weak. The best we can do is to remove outside deterrence to the growth of a healthy, secure, and free society in Ukraine. The way to do this is twofold. First, we need to stop our military intrusion into Ukrainian-Russian affairs, so diminishing Russian fears of aggression. And second, wherever possible, in whatever ways are acceptable to both parties, to assist in the growth of the Ukrainian economy and, indirectly, the stability and sanity of the Ukrainian government system. A first step in this direction could be for the Ukraine to join the European Union. This, in general terms, should be, and for our own sakes, must be our strategy. So that's former Kennedy administration official begging us not to move, as we are now moving. I say we, I mean the Pentagon and the White House, not to move, as the country is now moving towards nuclear war. Now, to counter what I feel is a lack of traction about this, again, I want to provide some details. This is from Global Research by Robert Perry. Again, the White House comment line, 202-456-1111, president@whitehouse.gov. If you're opposed to nuclear obliteration of the human race. A senior Ukrainian official is urging the West to risk a nuclear conflagration in support of a full-scale war with Russia that he says authorities in Kyiv are now seeking, another sign of the extremism that pervades the year-old U.S.-backed regime in Kyiv. In a recent interview with Canada's CBC Radio, Ukraine's Deputy Foreign Minister Vadim Perestaiko said, everybody is afraid of fighting with a nuclear state. We are not anymore in Ukraine. We've lost so many people of ours. We've lost so much of our territory, end quote. Perestaiko added, however dangerous it sounds, we have to stop Russia Russian President Vladimir Putin somehow, for the sake of the Russian nation as well, not just for the Ukrainians in Europe, in quotes. Yeah, he really said that. I wonder, this is one of those things that just, it's just a gobstopper, and it's beyond belief. Maybe that's why I don't feel traction on this. Now I want to test the waters. The number to call, 503-231-8187. This is Press Watch. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 503-231-8187. And I'll get to Thomas in just a moment. But first, I want to mention that Russian intercontinental ballistic missiles are believed to carry a total of approximately 1,000 strategic nuclear warheads. And I'm going to give you a scenario of one, which would not be what hit Portland. It would be several that hit Portland. It will be many, many which hit New York, which will be this scenario. But first, I want to talk to Thomas. Hi, Thomas. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Teresa. Yeah, the crickets are chirping deafeningly over here in Lake Oswego.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just... but anyway, yeah, the subject is almost taboo, and I really applaud you for consistently... broaching upon the issue of the dangers of nuclear conflict. You know, I mean, it's easy to get a Cassandra complex when people would think about these issues, because it's, you know, nobody really wants to hear it. But, you know, the things that scare me the most, that really frighten me, is that, you know, it seems apparent to me that the people in Washington, not just in the Congress, but also just in the entire governmental apparatus inside the Beltway, you know, they seem to be in this hermetically sealed echo chamber. And, you know, you go back to the Cold War proper, or you know, Cold War One, back in the 50s and 60s, and it seems to me there was a large percentage of people that were at least nominally aware of the horrors of, you know, World War II, because they were in the shadow of World War II. But what concerns me is these people that are in their, you know, 30s, 40s, or even 50s in government now. It's like, and this goes all the way up to the executive in both parties. I don't see the perspective or the awareness of the magnitude of some of these issues or the ramifications. You know, this, you know, and if people think, well, nuclear war, that's unthinkable. Well, think about how many unthinkable things the United States has been involved with in the last 10 years.
Yeah, as I started out the program, the totalitarianism post-Patriot Act is unthinkable to me, but it's going on right under our noses.
And, well, it's been normalized. And, you know, the thing, what's interesting, another thing, going back to the 90s, there were a number of high-ranking former U.S. military officers, generals, that signed a document. And I'm trying to remember the name of the document. You can Google it. It's a statement of admirals and generals, I believe, on the abolishment of nuclear weapons. And there were hundreds of high-ranking, mostly former military officers, a whole slew of them from Russia, a whole slew of them from the United States, who had this manifesto saying that nuclear weapons were a risk to humanity, in essence, and that they were obsolete. And that included General U.S. Air Force General Lee Butler, who was the former commander of the Strategic Air Command, hardly a tree-hugging liberal, and also included General Andrew Goodpaster, who was a former supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe and NATO. So, you know, and the thing that really frightens me is, you know, there again, the lack of perspective of magnitude, and this culture, this bipartisan culture, where you have essentially carbon copy neocon expansionist ideologies being promulgated by people in the Democratic and Republican Party. You know, you got now to pivot Asia, and this expansion of NATO, which began, guess what, in earnest under Bill Clinton, is only being continued. And I think that you're absolutely prescient in your comments, and people had better think about it, because guess what? There is no defense against nuclear weapons delivery.
This is true. You're not going to be able to jump into your basement and get away from it.
Nope. All of these cash cow programs that have been going on for decades now with Boeing, with Strategic Missile Defense, All of that stuff is almost completely ineffective, and there is no. And remember, a one megaton burst can start a fire 50 miles away.
That's what I want to get into. I want to quote Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Hey, thanks very much for your call. I really am heartened by your comments. I've been trying to establish that the U.S. really is risking nuclear war. With this nonsense in the Ukraine, I say nonsense. That's a very nice term for giving money and logistical support to literal Nazis. And I'm talking, of course, about Right Sector and Svoboda. If you have just a moment, you can look up Right Sector and you can look up Svoboda and you can find out that I'm not exaggerating in any way about who these people are and what flag they fly. But Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist is, of course, the source of that clock that stands at 3 minutes to midnight right now. It's been moved up because of the threat of nuclear war and because of instability. The madness at the top of the United States right now has everything to do with the fact that people have given up on confronting billionaireism. Billionaires have bunkers. They fantasize that they can escape and survive a nuclear war. Screw you. They're billionaires. And they're in control. We should ban billionaires. I've said many times, I love it when people get rich. I think everyone should be a millionaire or the equivalent. I would like to see a distribution of wealth according to labor and according to human rights in this country. It would solve a great many of our problems. And it would be relatively easy to do once we abandon the concept that there's anything just about having billionaires, thousands of millions of dollars, the wealth literally of kings of whole countries given to idiots who inherited it. Idiots who are mad with power, like the Koch brothers, poor things. Poor idiots. They just can't stop. We have to stop thinking that this is the right thing to do because these people are in power. And right now, that has this imbalance of power, this lack of access that starts with the economic level. It starts with us, you know, demeaning each other and saying that we don't even deserve $15 an hour as a minimum wage. This horrific obedience and submissiveness of the American population, which characterizes the American population this time. Sorry, it's true. I know there's a lot of exceptions out there, and I know, and I'm very proud of the KBOO audience, because I've seen time and again that ain't necessarily so, but it is of Americans. And I want to, when I talk about this, I'm trying to bring up an understanding of this sort of death that is facing us at this time. For me, it doesn't come from so much existential fear. Because I'm in my mid-50s, I've really had a good life. I've had an amazing change of perspectives. As a transgender person, I've met so many people. I've had the wonderful experience of broadcasting for half my life on community radio. I've traveled. I've had wealth and lost it, regained it. Wonderful life. That can't be taken from me now. Of course, my life is going to end at some point, so I don't have maybe the appropriate fear that someone, say, in their 20s might have, thinking, am I going to get to raise any kids? Are there going to be any kids? I already got to raise kids. It was great. So my concern is for the survival of the race, and let me just explain that a little bit in detail. Number to call, 503-231-8187, Russian intercontinental ballistic missiles, which carry 1,000 strategic nuclear warheads, have been updated. They now have little, let's see, what do you call those things? Little directable, well, when they re-enter, when they go ballistic, they're still directable and smart, and they change their trajectory so that they can't be shot down by anti-ballistic missile weapons. They come in such numbers they cannot be shot down by lasers. We don't have such lasers, I should add. Little tangs pop out on them. It's as easy as that, and changes their trajectory. Let's see, what would you call that object? A little spoiler. It's just a little, you know, at that speed, it only takes a little piece of metal. Anyway, they're updated. this from Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. About 700 warheads are rated at 800 kilotons. That is, each has the explosive power of 800,000 tons of TNT. What follows is a description of the consequences of the detonation of a single such warhead over Midtown Manhattan in the heart of New York City. And Thomas, if you can just hang on for a minute, I want to give part of this to give you some idea. Excuse me, it's Mike. The initial fireball, the warhead would be probably be detonated slightly more than a mile above the city. We're talking about New York, and once again, we're talking about one weapon, and of course there will be many dozens of weapons targeted at New York, and two, three for Portland, you can be sure. To maximize the damage created by the blast wave, within a few tenths of a millionth of a second after detonation, the center of the warhead would reach a temperature of roughly 200 million degrees Fahrenheit. That's about 100 million degrees Celsius, or about 4 to 5 times the temperature at the center of the sun. A ball of superheated air would form, initially expanding outward at millions of miles per hour. It would act like a fast-moving piston on the surrounding air, compressing it on the edge of the fireball and creating a shockwave of vast size and power. This is one Russian nuclear weapon. After 1 second, the fireball would be roughly a mile in diameter. It would have cooled from its initial temperature of many millions of degrees to about 16,000 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly 4,000 degrees hotter than the surface of the sun. On a clear day with average weather conditions, the enormous heat and light from the fireball would instantly ignite fires over a total area of about 100 square miles. That's one weapon. Within seconds after the detonation, fires set within a few miles of the fireball would burn violently. These fires would form gigantic masses of heated air to rise, drawing cooler air from surrounding areas toward the center of the fire zone from all directions. As the massive winds drove flames into areas where fires had not yet fully developed, the fires set by the detonation would begin to merge. Within tens of minutes of the detonation, fires from near and far would join, forming a single gigantic fire. The energy released by this mass fire would be 15 to 50 times greater than the energy produced by the nuclear detonation. Now, how do we know that? We've done that kind of thing. I say we, this nation, in the 40s, intentionally firebombed cities like Tokyo, Dresden, to create firestorms. So we know about firestorms. We studied them. We've done them. We roasted thousands and thousands and thousands of people to death with firestorms. I have more on that description of one nuclear weapon. But I'll get back to it in a minute because I want to talk to Mike. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Well, very good show. My question, and I don't have answers on it, is focusing in a little bit. What about the left in this country? What about the left in this community and its lack of focus on imperialism suddenly? And I have to wonder if these boneheaded policy moves have been performed by John McCain and Sarah Palin, whether there would be 40,000 people in the street. So I wonder what your opinion is on this, because I see it, and
well,
well connected with organizing folks, and I just see crickets in, like you say, real crickets.
Well, I do think that the left has been subsumed by the Obama administration. There was an attempt. It is clear to me, as it is to many people, that whatever Obama's personal intention or policies might be, he serves as a face for the Pentagon and for business as usual. And in these categories, in the category of threatening nuclear war, or several other categories, and I suspect including climate changes, despite his apparent pose to shut down the pipeline, which he didn't really do, the Keystone Pipeline. He's just business as usual. That's not to denigrate any of the moves he has made to liberate certain sections of the population, but we ain't there. And the left needs to wake up from that, because that face is being used to manipulate. And frankly, it's being used in a racist way.
I'm also wondering whether, you know how if you practice certain moves, they become instinctive. You know, if you're learning to play ball or learning some athletic activity, if you practice certain things, you commit them to muscle memory.
You condition yourself, yeah.
Yeah, but if you stop practicing certain things, you get less ability to do it. So the left has practiced certain issues over and over again, particularly under this administration, like you say very succinctly, and we've let other skills atrophy. And so I just see people who just can't analyze it. I mean, it's not like they have an explanation about why it's not important. They just don't seem to have the tools to analyze it. And so, I mean, I wonder if that's a starting place, just like what you're doing with the talk here.
Good thoughts, and thanks for sharing them.
Okay, take care.
Number to call, 503-231-8187. Been talking about a hurricane of fire. Hurricane of fire, talking about the detonation of one Russian nuclear weapon, 800 kilotons over New York. The mass fire or firestorm would quickly increase in intensity, heating enormous volumes of air that would rise at speeds approaching 300 miles per hour. This chimney effect would pull cool air from the outside the fire zone toward the center of the fire at speeds of hundreds of miles per hour. The superheated ground winds of more than a hurricane force would further intensify the fire. As the edge of the fire rose, the winds would be powerful enough to uproot trees 3 feet in diameter and suck people from outside the fire into it. The inrushing winds would drive the flames from burning buildings horizontally along the ground, filling city streets with flames and firebrands, breaking in doors and windows, causing the fire to jump sometimes hundreds of feet, swallowing anything if not violently combusting. These above hurricane force ground winds would have average air temperatures well above the boiling point of water. The targeted area would be transformed into a huge hurricane of fire, producing a lethal environment throughout the entire fire zone. Goodbye, New York. The fireball would vaporize the structures directly below it and produce an immense blast wave and high-speed winds, crushing even heavily built concrete structures. Hello. Good morning. There's a threat of nuclear war. Number to call, 503-231-8187, and Amy is on the air. Mimi is on the air.
Hey, Teresa, it's Mimi from Radcast in Nonex Northwest. Thanks for this show. I'm just really glad that you are explaining to people what this would look like, and it would look like this before you even know it, because you'd be gone. You know what I mean?
Oh, yes,
it's
absolutely.
Like, it's not like you're going to be hanging out going, wow, look at what's happening. You're just gone. You're just vaporized, along with the concrete, along with everything else, you know? And this stuff is so real. And I don't know. I missed the very beginning of your show, so I don't know if you said this. I'm guessing you probably did, that Obama is going to go ahead with his plan for NATO missiles to be placed in Ukraine. I believe that they're already over there, from what an account that I read the other day, that they're already armed and they're on the border.
Well, I started off with an account of a military parade 1,000 feet from the Russian border.
Yes. Okay. I saw that I saw that online yesterday, and it was interesting. About 6 months ago, I saw a tweet from Helen Caldicott, and she was saying at that point, 6 months ago, that her fear was we really are going to nuclear war. And I thought, wow, you know, I know Helen, and I thought, wow, she's really putting this out. This must be a hell of a lot more real than I had thought, you know? And then I followed this whole story until your broadcast right now. And it is so real. And I just had to chime in and tell people this is not something that may or may not happen. I suppose it may not happen, but it sure looks like all roads are heading in this path, and no one is playing. Well, this is for real.
I really thank you for making that point. And it's heartening to me to think that it's not entirely just crickets out there, and that some people realize just how bad this danger is. Couple of points I've been trying to make, not just that nuclear war is this bad in prospect, but that it's really being risked at this time. I've been saying for months now that Tupolev nuclear bombers have been cruising off Britain, off Sweden, off the United States, holding their cruise missiles. These old Tupolev bear bombers are turboprops. They only go 600 miles an hour, but those cruise missiles are well nigh unstoppable, and they certainly will deliver those hundreds of megatons. Hey, thanks very much for calling in, Mimi.
Thanks for the show.
Number call, 503-231-8187. There is another point that I want to make. I do want to pass on more of this description of destruction in just a moment, but the real sadness would be for someone who was more than 100 miles away from such a blast, because they don't get to die quickly. That's the really gross thing about nuclear war is the the light and the radiation at a certain distance, you don't get to be incinerated, which is really too bad, because the first thing that happens is that you're blind and then you start dying of radiation, which is a gross way to go. And Paul is on the air. I just can't keep names in my head. 503-231-8187, and Paul is on the air. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Teresa. I just wanted to talk about this Ukraine thing for a moment.
All right.
It's kind of sad. You know, my family actually moved here in 89 after the collapse of the Soviet Union, so it's a little personal. You know, we've got family members out there that are dying as civilians because of this whole mess in Ukraine, and I don't know what to think about it other than it's kind of scary. It seems like maybe the last step in the endgame scenario to bring about the New World Order. And that's maybe extreme to some people, but that's kind of what I'm seeing. You know, if we did have a nuclear war, it would be a perfect stage for the right candidate to step up and, you know, create peace, so to speak. Well, I just wanted to say that, you know, it's sad, and I hope people really think about this before we get to that point. And maybe we need to start rallying and get out there and protest this. So thank you.
I think you're right. There needs to be a protest. I think there needs to be a general strike to stop billionaireism and to stop Pentagonism and nuclear war. Number call 503-231-8187. Ground Zero, Midtown Manhattan. The fireball from one of the 1,000 nuclear weapons, excuse me, that are aimed at the United States, which threaten us now because of the Ukraine situation, the Estonia situation, the Pentagon situation, the billionaireism situation, would vaporize the structures directly below it in Manhattan and produce an immense blast wave and high-speed winds, crushing even heavily built concrete structures within a couple miles of Ground Zero. The blast would tear apart high-rise buildings and expose their contents to the solar temperatures. It would spread fires by exposing ignitable surfaces, releasing flammable materials, and dispersing burning materials. At the Empire State Building, Grand Central Station, the Chrysler Building, and St. Patrick's Cathedral, about one-half to three-quarters of a mile from Ground Zero, light from the fireball would melt asphalt in the streets, burn paint off walls, melt metal surfaces within a half second of the detonation, roughly 1 second later. The blast wave and 750-mile-per-hour winds would arrive, flattening buildings and tossing burning cars into the air like leaves in a windstorm. Throughout Midtown, the interiors of vehicles and buildings in the line of sight of the fireball would explode into flames. Once again, this is from nuclear scientists who've studied this very carefully, especially after many, many detonations, unfortunately, which have left strontium in the bones of millions, including me. I was born in 58. Slightly more than a mile from Ground Zero are the neighborhoods of Chelsea, Midtown East, and Lenox Hill, as well as the United Nations. At this distance, for a split second, the fireball would shine 10,000 times brighter than the desert sun at noon. All combustible materials illuminated by the fireball would spew fire and black smoke. Grass, vegetation, and leaves on trees would explode into flames. The surface of the ground would explode into superheated dust. Any flammable material inside buildings, paper, curtains, upholstery that was directly exposed to the fireball would burst into flame. The surfaces of the bronze statues in front of the UN would melt. Marble surfaces exposed to the fireball would crack, pop, and possibly evaporate. At this distance from the fireball, it would take about 4 seconds for the blast wave to arrive. As it passed over, the blast wave would engulf all structures and crush them. It would generate ferocious winds of 400 to 500 miles an hour that would persist for a few seconds. The high winds would tear structural elements from buildings and cause them to disintegrate explosively into smaller pieces. Some of these pieces would become destructive projectiles, causing further damage. The superheated dust-laden winds would be strong enough to overturn trucks and buses. Departing from this text, the bombs that were dropped on Japan, which had such horrific effects, were single bombs of 15 kilotons, about 10-15 kilotons. This is a description of typical Russian ballistic nuclear weapon, 800 kilotons, and would come in numbers of 1,000 times this scenario. 2 miles from Ground Zero, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, with all its magnificent historical treasures, would be obliterated. 2.5 miles from Ground Zero, in Lower Manhattan, the East Village and Stuyvesant Town, the fireball would appear 2,700 times brighter than a desert sun at noon. There, thermal radiation would melt and warp aluminum surfaces, ignite the tires of autos, and turn exposed skin to charcoal before the blast wave arrived, thankfully, and ripped apart the buildings. 3 to 9 miles from Ground Zero, Midtown bordered by relatively wide Hudson and East Rivers, and fires would start simultaneously in large areas on both sides of these waterways. That is Queens and Brooklyn, as well as Jersey City and West New York, along Although the direction of the fiery winds in regions near the river would be modified by the water, the overall wind pattern from the huge neighboring fire zones would be similar to that of a single mass fire, with its center at Midtown Manhattan, 3 miles from Ground Zero in Union City, New Jersey, and Astoria, Queens. The fireball would be bright as 1900 suns and deliver more than 5 times the thermal energy deposited at the perimeter of the mass fire at Hiroshima. In Greenpoint, Brooklyn, and Civic Center of Lower Manhattan, clothes worn by people in direct line of sight of the fireball would burst into flames or melt. Uncovered skin would be charred, causing third or fourth degree burns. And then Jesus would show up and make everything better, right? Sorry, couldn't resist. I get to say that I was brought up with that nonsense. Number to call, 503-231-8187. And Linda's on the air.
Hi, Teresa. It's Linda. I was remembering that when my children were young, when my daughter, who's now, I believe, 35, was five, we were thinking thermonuclear war was very close. And I remember people spray painting the shadows of bodies on the ground like they had been at Hiroshima. And my daughter asked me, shouldn't she die rather than wait until the war came? Which was a horrible question to hear from your daughter.
Oh, and a lot of people thought that, yeah.
Yeah, and I've been, of course, grateful that she's grown up and is wonderful. And actually hearing what you're saying has made me deeply grateful for everything that I have had. On the other hand, it's really hard to comprehend the depth of trouble that we're in on this planet. And I was already thinking, we really need to be out there. We're on war at every front. And now we're saying it's official, we're at war on every front. You know, we've got to stop these wars and people who care about the environment. We, you know, warfare itself is the most destructive thing on the planet.
Well, you know, Linda, I mean, all your
nuclear war, could you get more destructive to the planet? I don't know why we're quiet either. I would be out in the street if there was a demonstration called, but I haven't called one. Have you? I mean, do you know what I'm saying? I mean, we know there are organizations who do that.
Yeah.
But somehow it's not happening.
Well, and, you know, we do radio, Linda, and so it's our job to get out and point the reasons for a protest, and it's the job for other people, and it's also a violation of FCC policy to call for a direct action.
Oh, well, good, I understand.
So it's our job
But I do think we somehow, I mean, part of it is that it's overwhelming, and I know that on a daily basis, I just try to live my life in a way that if I would have a second before death, I would not regret.
Right on. I mean, that's what I was going to get around to saying, is that I really hear your grief in this, and yet all we ever are granted in this life is this moment, and this moment is glorious, and this moment is full of possibilities. So hooray for the moment, this moment, and let's move against this. This is our world.
Love you, Teresa.
It doesn't belong to the billionaires.
That's right.
Thanks, Linda.
Bye.
Time is 9:56. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Press Watch. I'm Teresa Mitchell. I've been talking about the constant provocations versus Russia, how serious the provocations are, how much the Russians have been trying to signal basically this message. And I'll bet you can commiserate with this. Here's the message from the Russians. You ready? We'd rather die on our feet than live on our knees. That's all they're saying. And so who says that sort of thing to you, and under what circumstances do people normally say that? Do people come up to you in the street and say, I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees? No, you have to be really severely oppressing someone for them to come up with an attitude like that. So what's happening? The U.S. is threatening Russia, threatening, marching, literally rolling tanks along the border, supporting Nazis. The United States is supporting Nazis. Oh, say, can you see? Well, I hope that you'll stay tuned to KBOO Portland, because there's more programming coming up. And it's what you, I believe, normally expect at 10 o'clock. Just to finish up, you should turn to thebulletin.org. It's the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. After the fire had burned out, they write, the street pavement would be so hot that even tracked vehicles did not pass over it for days. This is one nuclear weapon of the thousand that are aimed at us. Buried unburned material from collapsed buildings throughout the fire zone could burst into flames when exposed to air months after the firestorm had ended. Those who tried to escape through the streets would have been incinerated by the hurricane force winds filled with firebrands and flames. Even those able to find shelter in the lower level sub-basements of massive buildings would likely suffocate from the fire-generated gases or be cooked alive as their shelters heated to oven-like conditions. And that's not even the end of it. I urge you to look it up there at thebulletin.org, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. You've been listening to Press Watch, going out to you via the terrestrial transmitter on your personal untrackable, relatively untrackable, radio. And also via the World Wide Web to all the ships at sea.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland with just 1 minute to go before 10 o'clock. We're about 15 minutes away from Flashpoints. Today, historian Alfred McCoy on the real American exceptionalism and its roots in Nazi Germany. A look at the national movement to shut down killer drone operations and a commentary on actor Sean Penn's racist comment at the Academy Awards. Between the Covers, host on 11, David Naiman speaks with Sarah Gerard about her new novel Binary Star, an account of a young woman struggling with anorexia and her long-distance alcoholic boyfriend. At 11:30 today, the film show features Carla Rossi, a.k.a. Anthony Hudson, on the Queer Horror Festival. Also, local filmmaking brothers Sean and Christoph Whiteman talk about their first feature, Childhood Machine. And POWFest Tara Johnson Mettinger talks about the next generation of women filmmakers. That's all coming up, but up next, we believe, is Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. And that is coming up. By the way, this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Clackamas Community College Theater presenting the Laramie Project, a stage production based on extensive interviews of citizens of Laramie, Wyoming, in the aftermath of the murder of Matthew Shepard in 1998. The Laramie Project runs through March 8th at the Osterman Theater, and ticket information is available at clackamas.edu/theater or by calling 503-594-3158.